All right, so we are continuing our lesson book about discipleship, and today's analogy, comparison, is how is discipleship like being a soldier? So first of all, I would like somebody to describe to me what the Jews of the first century, what their interaction would have been with the military state of Rome. Because, I mean, I see soldiers at Chick-fil-A pretty often around here because the base is right over here. But what would somebody back then, their interaction have been with the military?
Depending on where you call.
Yeah. So they would use them to their own purposes as if they could, but the rest of the time. Yeah. Dennis, you were saying?
I was just going to say, depending on what city you lived in, because some of the cities didn't have Roman Catholics in them. Okay. Jews would.
Yeah, it was a military state. It's more like other countries today than it is our own country, where you have military patrolling the streets of cities. And it's more likely to see military in the cities than just out in the country. Just because it's more likely to see people in the city than it is out in the country. What are some places that the Bible or Jesus or whomever talks about interactions with soldiers?
I know that when you talk about Matthew 5, with Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, he talks about the ones who would compel you to go an extra mile or take your cloak, those kinds of things, and some of that had involvement with the Roman soldiers, and the fact that Roman soldiers could require citizenry to do something for them, the ideas go beyond that. The other one that I can think of is with the Apostle Paul, who basically had some protections because he was a Roman citizen that others did not have.
Yeah, they were pervasive, and they changed just how people's lives were. I mean, like what Stan was just talking about, you had the thing where if a Roman soldier compels you to carry something a mile, right? He could just come by and demand somebody, hey, carry this burden a mile. Jesus said, he tells you to carry it a mile, carry it 2 miles. That was just life. You could just be walking around the city doing your own thing, and somebody could say, hey, that guy can't carry his cross. You, pick it up. Carry it for him. It's like, I was just going to market. I had nothing to do with this. Doesn't matter. Soldier came and gave you an order. And I mean, they were burdensome, and they were imposing the Roman way. The Romans, like the Greeks before them, tended to let people hang on to bits of their culture, but they were still under the overarching auspices of the Roman state. There are places that describe tax collectors, which could be associated with the military, or at least protected by the military, and military folks themselves just abusing their positions. It was very, very common. And of course, they were also used as the police, if you will, right? And not a very just police. I mean, you think about when Jesus was taken in, and Pilate said at one point, I don't find anything wrong with him. I don't find anything wrong with him. So I'm going to have the soldiers beat him, and then we're going to let him go. He's innocent. He's perfectly innocent. But, you know, we're going to beat him anyhow, and then we're going to let him go. And, of course, the Jews weren't having any of that, and they wanted him to be crucified. But that wasn't an uncommon thing for you just to be completely mistreated by the military. And even the people that weren't, like you mentioned, not every city had a Roman garrison, but Jerusalem did. And the Jews were called to go to Jerusalem for feasts and things like that, so they would have had those kind of interactions also. And of course, it describes with Jesus' crucifixion that, you know, it was near town, and so a lot of people saw him because there's a lot of people coming and going. So the first section here is, we have a commander. Somebody turn over to 2 Timothy for me. 2 Timothy chapter 2. So he's saying here, all right, we're soldiers, but soldiers aren't just loose running around soldiering on your own. That's called being a mercenary. That's not what we are. We're soldiers in an army. So it says there in 2 Timothy 2, 1 through 4. Who can read that for me? Dennis has it.
You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier.
I don't know that we often think about it like that when we're thinking about soldiers. Thinking about the suffering hardship of being a soldier. What are some of the suffering hardships of being a soldier? Like even today, what are the suffering hardships of being a soldier? It was more so back then. You couldn't FaceTime back from Iraq or something back then, but... Yeah, being away from your family would be one of them. What else?
Going without contact to your friends, your family for months, years.
Yeah, months or years back in this time, definitely being out of contact with them.
Posted to severe climate or places in general.
Yeah, just put in extreme situations, be they the environment or be they the trauma of the situation.
Always prepared to die in battle.
Yeah, always having that hanging over your head that you could die in battle.
You're essentially owned by whatever state you are belonging to. You don't have control of your life at that point.
Yeah, not having control, and especially with conscription. If you didn't volunteer for the military back in this time, right? Then it'd be like, oh, I had a plan, you know, of what I was going to do or what my livelihood was going to be, and that plan was set aside. Let us read over in Matthew 8. Matthew 8, let's do verses 5 through 10. Who can read that? You don't have to raise your hand. Just start reading.
Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, the centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. For I am also a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, assuredly I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel.
We talked about this a little bit at that reading of the Gospel of John, whatever it was, a week or two ago. Because you've got Lazarus who died, and when Martha comes up to Jesus after Lazarus died, he said, Lord, if you had been here, you could have prevented him from dying. And then later Mary's told the teacher's looking for you. She goes and goes, if you had been here, you could have kept him from dying. And here we have a case where he's like, you don't have to be there. I understand how that works. Somebody just spell out the analogy or the allegory here with verse 9. What is the centurion is describing himself and applying it to Jesus. Someone describe Jesus. You get what I'm saying? Explain verse 9 to me, but talk about Jesus, not the centurion. Is it a confusing question?
Jesus did not pray like the centurion. He did not pray like the military man. He appeals to the heart of the man to follow him for who he is. The centurion, the unusual thing to me here is the centurion's concern.
That is a peculiar situation. A lot of the centurions in that time probably would have thought, well, this one's sick. Throw him out. Get me one that isn't sick. Yeah. So he had a strange bit of care. But I don't think the centurion was talking about Jesus having authority over people in this place. What was he talking about Jesus having authority over? He didn't order the slave to do something. Yeah, what were you saying?
Sickness, I would say.
The
situation, circumstance, which of course Jesus demonstrated on a lot of occasions, the ability to heal, or the ability to fly the wind, or whatever. He just understood the authority that Jesus had over the universe, or over creation, or over the circumstances.
Yeah, that's what he was talking about here. Jesus, you've got authority. I understand. You've got authority over blindness and weird things that you can't actually have authority over. You somehow have authority over them, and I get that. The first sentence is interesting, though, because he says that you're not worthy to come under my roof. Just speak the word, and he'll be healed. And then he's talking about this. You got authority over the illness, but the first thing he says is, "For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me." So he's saying, I'm under authority, and I'm over authority over these people that are under me. What was his point? What was the centurion's point in saying the first part? I may be guessing a little bit at what his point was. But what authority is Jesus under?
Father's.
He's under his Father's authority. He can't say anything. He's come down to do his Father's purpose. If his Father hadn't wanted him healing those people or whatever in the world, then he would not have been doing it.
I think, too, it may indicate the limit of the centurion's knowledge. He understood that Jesus had to be from God, had to have God's approval. He may not have known that he was the Son of God, the only begotten of the Father, but he did know, Lord Kyrios, was one of authority.
Yeah.
And his authority had to come from God.
He may have thought it came from Zeus. I mean, we don't know. But he understood the situation. You've got power from somewhere, and you have power over things. The indication it gives to me is that he didn't think that the power necessarily originated from Christ, which is not necessarily correct. But Christ is under authority. The next section, it talks about if we're soldiers, if we're an army, we're not just sitting there being an army for the fun of it. We're an army in a battle, and if we're battling, we're battling against somebody. We have an enemy. So what are the enemies? What are the enemies that we as soldiers and as the army of God are fighting against?
Sin.
Sin. Or fighting against sin. Where does sin come from?
People.
We're fighting against ourselves.
The devil.
We're fighting against other people. The devil. The devil originating a lot of temptations which lead to sin. And of course us, when our lusts are full grown. What about some more specifics? I don't know if specifics is the right word, but what else?
False religions.
Yeah, false teaching, false religions. A lot of times we talk about sins of commission and omission. So you think about it, all right, well, I'm going to battle this person who's saying something false. Or I'm going to battle this person that's doing something wrong. We also have to battle situations where nothing is being done. One of the things we have to battle is apathy or desertion. Things like that. Of course, the section here that he's talking about is that our primary adversary is the devil and the disciples of the devil. Why would somebody be a disciple of the devil?
Instead of doing it intentionally or on purpose, it's just by the life that you're leading, you are by definition in the devil's arm. If you're not the Lord's army, you're in the devil's army.
So you can accidentally be in the devil's army. Can you accidentally be in the Lord's army?
No.
That's probably why one of the paths is narrow and the other one's wide. It's a lot easier to get into the wide path. You can do it without even realizing you did it. Let's read 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. Someone read that.
Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him. For this end, I also wrote that I might put you to the test whether you are obedient in all things. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices.
Sorry, I'm getting distracted by the differences in my translation and your translation. So, point he's making here is that our adversary, the devil, is out there. He's on the prowl. He's described as a roaring lion. He's described in all these different ways. And it says here, you know, we've got to be ready at all times. And it says specifically here in verse 11 that we are not ignorant of his schemes. What are his schemes? What does Satan try to use against us? Anything and everything. Weaknesses of the flesh.
Doubtings.
Doubting.
Lying.
Weaknesses of the heart. What did you say? Lying? Pride,
bitterness and anger.
Bitterness and anger. He's got a lot of tools. We'll talk about the armor of God here in a minute, but he's got a lot of tools. The fiery darts of the devil. I like the first answer, anything and everything. What are some things Satan has used that you might not think he would use? Either in your personal life or just something in the Bible that aren't necessarily obvious to begin with. Friends and family. He can even use something good. The love of your children. You know, we talked about in the first lesson, whoever does not hate his mother and father And we said, all right, it doesn't mean hate. It means that your love for God has to be so much more. By comparison, this love is nothing. Well, he was describing a real problem. If this love supersedes and you start doing things that are wrong or not good, you know, how many times have we seen a situation, well, I just can't do that, you know, I love them too much, and it's like, but you're helping them on the road to destruction. Because you don't want to hurt them. I don't want to hurt your feelings and tell you that you don't know how to navigate, so I'll just let you drive off the cliff. Satan uses God's own words. He did it in the garden. He did it with Jesus. Use anything and everything. He'll use the Bible. He'll use anything.
I like that phrase in the final paragraph on it. He doesn't fight fair.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And when you think about a war situation, like even if you watch, what's it called? Mixed martial arts. Even if you watch mixed martial arts, right? And it's not like boxing, and it's not like a taekwondo match. It's a, like, bring whatever you got. But it's not really. They still got a few rules, right? You're not allowed to gouge people's eyes out and crazy stuff like that. But you are in war. And it turns out in the heat of the battle, nobody's actually thinking about the Geneva Convention. Nobody's sitting there going, well, that wasn't fair. It's like, well, but you're dead and I'm not. You know this passage here where he says he's a predator attacking the weak and the unsuspecting. He disguises himself and his true motives. You know, get me thinking about camouflage and sneaking up on people and picking people off and stuff like that. But there's this story that's popped up on my YouTube feed a few times talking about scientists that are out there studying zebras, and y'all have probably heard it. All our algorithms are synced, right? Google's listening to us all right now. Google and Siri are listening to us all, and they'll talk to you about something I said here today. But you got these scientists, and they're studying zebras. So they're out there, wherever in the world they are, Africa or something, and they're studying zebras. And so they go, and they're like writing down this stuff. It's like, all right, well, this zebra, you know, seems to be doing this and thus. And they write it down, and they look back up. Oh, man. Which zebra was it? And they don't know, because that's where zebras get their camouflage, right? They're camouflaged against the herd. They're like, well, how can we study this? How can we be like, well, this zebra always does this whenever they get to a body of water if we can't figure out which zebra is which? So they go out there and they tag them. They either put a tag in their ear like you do with cattle or whatever in the world, or they put like a bit of red paint on one of their haunches and whatnot. And then they don't study that animal because that animal is dead, because the lions or whatever come and kill it because they've messed up its camouflage. And it turns out that they learned something by accident about lions. That lions don't go and pick off the weak or the infirmed. They pick off the ones they can identify. That zebra has a limp? I can follow that. That zebra is going to die. That zebra has a red mark on its haunch? I can see that. I can follow that. That zebra is going to die. That zebra's off by itself and not part of the herd? I can see that. That zebra's going to die. Well, Satan works the same way. If you're by yourself and don't have the support of the herd, you're a lot easier to pick off. If you're not staying healthy, you're a lot easier to pick off. If you identify yourself as something that might not quite fit into the group, you're easier to pick off. It works that way in battle. It's easier to snipe individuals on the battlefield. If you've got a group of people and you snipe somebody in that group of people, you've given away your position. Now I'm talking too much. Let's move on. I'm supposed to let y'all talk more. I'm not going to go over this a lot. We've gone over the armor a ton of times. I've been going over the armor since I was 4. In fact, last time I taught about the armor, I said, I want somebody to tell me something about the armor, the whole armor of God, that I've never heard before, to see what the interesting thing is. So, obviously, soldiers need to wear armor when they go into battle. If you're the crazy person walking out there just in your regular t-shirt and shorts, things are not going to go well for you. But being in the army, being soldiers, being in this constant battle, is a way of life. We talked about that back in the previous lessons too, and like with the athletes and whatnot. It's a way of life. If you're just casually doing a sport, you're not going to win the Olympics. It's a way of life. So, how does wearing this and having this and being mindful of this all the time, how does that affect your life? Okay, yeah, when you're actively in battle. But you think about the soldiers back then, right? They had this stuff all the time. The soldiers even just marching through town, doing regular stuff. I'm just walking through town, you know, watching this convoy or having this guy carry my pack for a mile or whatever in the world. They always had their armor. They always had their weapon. But it was more than that. It was a way of life. So how does this being a way of life affect us?
Well, we're less likely to save men if we're constantly on the lookout and aware that he can do that. He can get us anytime.
So we're always prepared. It's not a I have to put this on real quick kind of thing. Do you ever take your armor off? Are you ever like, I'm exhausted, I need a moment to just sit back, recuperate?
Seeing that it's a metaphor, you shouldn't, but not even a shower. Yeah, it is quite often. There's an interesting thing about concealed carry. And I've gone through the class and all that, and one of the things that becomes obvious to me is some individuals are so dedicated to this way of life and looking at it, is the gun is the first thing they put on in the morning, the last thing they take off at night. It's never far from them. They go to take a shower, it's right there, you know, every single thing, because at any point in time, even when you seem to be the safest or feel yourself safest, you're still somewhat vulnerable to invasion or other problems, and they just never want to be without a weapon to defend themselves. And I think that's kind of the attitude that we should have with regard to the armor. We should never, ever be without it. It is to be a constant companion of us at all times, or else we're vulnerable.
Yeah, we're on the battlefield all the time. It's not like we're on leave and it's like, all right, I don't have to wear my full set of gear when I, you know, whatever, go to the beach with my family or something like that.
Another thing is, those centurions back in that day, they fought most of their armor. It wasn't given to them by the military. They went out and bought their shield and their breastplate and their sword. And so they could go out and buy the jeans they could find.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, it wasn't the most expensive or the shiniest or the whatever in the world. They were looking for what was effective, what was going to keep them safe, what was going to be usable as a weapon. I mean, you see in discussions, or I guess even movies of this time, or in World War I or World War II? What do you do when you're out on the battlefield? You don't neatly get everything together and set it to the side and put your pajamas on and lay down in your foxhole and whatever in the world. They're sleeping with their gun or they're sleeping with their sword and stuff like that. And if something goes down, it's there. It's ready. They're good to go. Also, in a army culture, especially if the culture is, you know, it's not just I'm in the army over here, it's truly a way of life, it ends up being something that is part of the family, where the kids are learning to use swords at young ages, where the fathers spar with the sons to teach them how to operate things. Same type of thing here. We should be training one another. We should be working with one another. The next sections we must train, but it applies to, like, with our children also. You know, if you're going to church every week and your kids are in Bible class and stuff like that, and it's like, well, that should take care of them. Off to the real world, off to college. They'll probably have all the training and equipment and know how to wield the sword, and they'll be fine out there. You are very likely to be disappointed. It is, unless that discipline has come inside themselves to become a disciple, and they've been training themselves, they're not going to be ready. And so we need to look at doing that training with the sword, with the shield, how to have your armor put on correctly. That was something somebody made a point in a sermon one time with this. It was like, you know, if you don't put your breastplate on correctly, there are going to be gaps that swords can get into. So what does it mean? But we don't want to carry the metaphor too far today. I'm actually remembering to change the slides this time. I'm so proud of myself. Next section, we must train. So this is interesting. He talks about boot camp, exercise, training, drills, stuff like that. Do we run drills? Do we run drills here at Westside? What kind of boot camp or drills or stuff like that do we have? We got Bible drill. We got little soldiers. Do we have big soldiers? Do we need a Bible drill for the adults? Have y'all ever sat there and watched the kids' Bible drill and not known some of the answers? That's not good. That's not a good situation to be in. There have been a couple of times where the person doing the Bible drill would ask a question. A kid would answer correctly and be like, "Well, no, 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 it's his son." And then they're like, oh no, wait a minute, you got it right. Never mind. That's a little embarrassing. You don't want your 5-year-old to beat you at the sword sparring match. That wouldn't be good. You know, there used to be debates. And you'd see a debate between, whatever. It wasn't just in the Church of Christ. You'd see like a Methodist preacher debating a Baptist preacher or whatever in the world. There used to be debates like that. But that was normally amongst preachers. Normally. I think we find those kind of drills more challenging. I don't know if they make us uncomfortable or what the deal is. I know that I didn't really get it very well when I started coming to Westside, because I would try to do those drills, and I had been on debate teams and stuff, and I had somebody freak out really hard on me one time because I was in a debate class and I had been assigned to the pro-choice side of a debate. And so I went in and I debated the pro-choice side of the debate. And I won, by the way. Maybe that made him even more uncomfortable. But like, how could you argue for that? And it was like, well, at the end of the debate, there was a class. We talked about the debate. What did people do well? What did people not do well? And so I could go at the end of the debate and go, hey, here's what you should have said to counteract what I said. Because I shouldn't have won. Because I was wrong. But I did win. And I had the same kind of thing happen here in Westside a couple of times, where we'd have a class and I'd be like, well, what about this? And I didn't believe the point I was making. I was trying to make the point because we need to be equipped to have that discussion when we're on the battlefield. And you could equate it to something like, something like basketball, say, right? If you had practices of basketball and it was always the five of you running in there and scoring, and it's like, we're going to practice. We're going to run this drill and score. We're going to run that drill and score. And you never put anybody opposing you. And then you went out and played a game where there were five other people that were trying to stop you, and you'd never practiced what to do if people were trying to stop you from scoring. You're going to get destroyed. You're going to get absolutely destroyed. Same thing in a battlefield. When you train an army, you don't just all sit there and swing your swords at the air. You train against one another. It's kind of like with the children and going to college. If they've never learned how to have those discussions or to fight that battle or to use that sword, they're going to be in trouble. Well, if the first time you've ever thought about the argument, that the false argument that somebody's going to make, is right when they make it to you, you're not going to be ready for it. You're not going to know off the top of your head how to respond to that. Especially with the tricks of the devil, right? You ever think about that? What if the devil came down and tempted you like he tempted Jesus? He said, well, the scripture says right here this. And you're just like, well, I never thought about that. Well, that's dangerous. You need to have thought about that. I'm more careful now. Now I'll say, well, I was talking to a Baptist one time and they said this. Because some people went away from those classes and they thought, Justin believes X, Y, Z. And it's like, I didn't say that. I was just trying to get people to think. I do worry we don't run enough drills. I never figured out how to make boot camp work into the analogy. I don't know how that works. Oh, we need to speed up. Hebrews 5, 12 through 14. We're not going to read it. You get the passages that are talking about, this passage is talking about you need to be skilled, right? You guys ought to be teachers, but now I got to teach you the rudiments of what's going on. You should be able to eat meat by now, and all you can have is milk. Like, you're not to the point that you're going to be. Well, obviously with our analogy here, what happens, right? If you have the meat eaters go up against the milk drinkers in a battle, who's going to win? You know who eats meat? Satan. Satan eats meat. He's ready for battle.
I would think that in the drills and training, I agree with you, it's very much needed. I have opportunities occasionally to address error right ahead, you know, head to head with the one who's promoting the error. I never feel comfortable in that. Never feel fully prepared. Always feel like I need to go back and do some more studying and working, make sure I get it right and do a good job. But one of the ways, we talked about drilling before, is being able to wield the truth against error. The more you know the truth, the better you know the truth, the more likely it's going to come to you how to deal with that. I think that's something that Jesus had as an advantage during his temptation. It is written, he always had at his beck and call the answer to the argument. There is the need to be able to recognize what the answer is, but the more knowledge you have, the better able you're going to be able to accomplish that. So part of the training is study and meditation.
Yeah, I mean, you see that when you're learning to use like a sword, or you're learning martial arts techniques or stuff like that, where you're presented with somebody attacking you in a way that you've never seen before, but you are so familiar with the sword, or you're so familiar with the martial art, it's like, well, I've never seen that before, but out of my toolbox of skills that I've developed over time, here's what I would use in this situation, even though I've never seen it before. A lot of times when people come with arguments about how we should live life, or arguments about the Bible, and you're just like, well, I've never heard that before. But I don't have to have heard that before, right? Like, I don't, you know, somebody says, well, just use oil instead of water in this recipe. And it's like, well, you can't just replace all the water with oil. Like, that is not going to work, you know, and that's pretty obvious to learn. Or at least you can make that mistake once and you won't make it again. Then someone says, well, really, you should use motor oil. And it's like, well, I've never heard that before, but I really don't have to think about it because of my experiences in the past. I'm positive we should not be putting motor oil into these cookies. It's interesting. Somebody comes and says, you know, well, I don't know what to do in this situation. It's like, well, have you looked in the Bible about it? Well, I've been just thinking about it. Well, if you'll listen, there's a ton in here about, you know, every situation known to man. I told somebody one time, if you're ever sitting there and you just don't know what to do, just open up Proverbs and start reading it. And I bet you don't get 4 or 5 chapters in before you stumbled upon something that applies to what you're thinking about in that situation. Some folks think they aren't experienced enough to fight. That's not how an army works. Not once you're on the battlefield. Everyone has to fight once you're on the battlefield. Maybe you're not the Green Beret, maybe you're not the Navy SEAL, but you have an ability to fight, and you can't say, well, I'm not ready, I'm going to train more, I'm going to this more, and years go by and stuff like that. The battle is real and active and ongoing now. Section 5 here, talking about the fight. Want to make the point on the second point there, wrestling or struggling. Question 9 asks, what does the word wrestle imply about our spiritual battle? We're not range warriors.
Right.
We're not running predator drones from halfway around the world. We are up close and personal. And it turns out that even if you just watch whatever, fencing or something like that, there are grapples involved in fencing. You end up tangling up and grabbing the arm and shoving the person off and stuff like that. It's not just swords hitting one another. That's not the battle. It's a rough and tumble wrestling, you know, messy kind of battle. I'm going to read real quick 2 Corinthians 10, 1 through 6. Now I, Paul, myself urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold towards you in absence, I ask that when I am present, I need not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapon of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powered for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, and we are ready to punish all disobedient whenever your obedience is complete. That is a great passage to talk about our role as a soldier. We are constantly active. We are warring according to the Spirit. That's what our weapons are, and they are powerful, and we must use them to destroy. It actually uses the word destroy there. He says that we must humbly correct people so that they can come to their senses and escape the snare of the danger. That's true, but sometimes you're dusting off your feet, right? Sometimes Jesus came to battle with the Pharisees, and he wasn't really looking to change their mind in that moment. He was looking to stop them from hurting other people. And of course, the sword of the Spirit cuts to bone and marrow. It pricks people's hearts. It's going to hurt them if you're using it right. But if you're using it right, it will do good. All right. Thanks, everyone. Next time we will be talking about discipleship and comparing that to being clay in the potter's hand.